Hi, I'm Carmen Wong Ulrich, and this is your Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of November 22nd, 2013. So this show is about you, how you can get more money and more value out of the choices that you make every day. This week in How We Live Money, stock market records, should we care? Prepaid debit cards, it's time for a takedown. And a financial reality check for expecting parents. But first up, healthcare.
Hey, do you have that Obamacare?
Obamacare? What's that?
Obamacare?
And so far, it's been an unmitigated disaster.
Yeah, but see, the problem is not everyone has signed on to it yet. Okay.
La ley de cuidado de salud a bajo precio, a veces llamada Obamacare.
Do you know that Obamacare and the Affordable Care Act are the same thing?
No, they're not.
You may be suffering from presidential depression. Even your friends have turned against you.
The enrollment period, it was a disaster.
Welcome to the Health Insurance Marketplace. Let's get started.
All this Affordable Care Act chatter, from complaints to gratitude to funny. But we can all agree on one thing. Healthcare, as we know it, is changing. So we start the show today with our special collaboration with the New York Times. It's called The New Math of Healthcare. It's insight and interviews on how healthcare fits into our lives today. Now, one big question about the Affordable Care Act, particularly from those of you who live paycheck to paycheck, is, should I purchase the insurance or risk a penalty? The New York Times' Tara Siegel Bernard crunched the numbers for us. Hi, Tara.
Hi, Carmen. Thank you.
Now, Tara, anytime anybody hears about a penalty, whether we are liable to get it or not, everybody wants to know, how much is it going to cost and how does it work?
Well, in 2014, individuals are going to pay either a flat fee or 1% of their income above the income filing threshold, which is about $10,000 for an individual, a little bit more, double that for a couple. But over time, that penalty is going to rise, which would presumably make insurance the more attractive option, depending on the circumstances as time goes on. But in 2016, the penalty is going to cap out at 2.5% of your income above the filing threshold, or $695 per adult.
But Tara, you know, as we know, though, that when it comes to insurance, that even though your monthly costs may be lower, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's actually going to cost you less money because things happen. So how much is this, though, a question of affordability?
Right. Well, for younger people, affordability might be more of an issue. But of course, you know, we're not buying insurance hoping that we're using it. We're buying it to minimize, you know, the risk of financial ruin. There are expected to be about 6 million people who do pay the penalty. So if you are one of those people, or expect to be one of those people, you probably want to take a closer look at exactly how this may impact you.
And looking at that in terms of the penalty, though, with younger adults, I think that, you know, most folks think, oh, yes, they think they're invincible. But it really is kind of a cost issue. And the idea of risk and odds, where does that risk lie? And what realistically does it look like?
If you're somebody who manages to skate through life relatively unscathed, paying the penalty is certainly going to be the cheaper option, especially if you do not qualify for a subsidy. But insurance may start to become a more attractive option once you begin to factor in the cost of, you know, treating an ailment as common as a back injury, which apparently is pretty common for people between the ages of 25 to 34. That's one of the top five reasons for an outpatient visit. So if you consider a young guy, for instance, living in New York, who earns about $50,000, which means that his income is a little bit too high for subsidized coverage, and he received treatment for his back, he would be billed $4,890 in 2014. And that's according to an analysis by an actuarial firm called Milliman. His total outlay that year would be about over $5,000. But if he brought a silver plan on the New York Health Insurance Exchange, he would actually pay a little bit less. So in that case, buying the insurance looks like the better deal. And in fact, it might be an even better deal if you're living outside of New York, where insurance tends to be a bit cheaper.
Now, and you mentioned that a lot of folks actually have income so low that they're not going to even have or be subject to this penalty. So how do they qualify for the exception? Income versus...
Right. Well, a lot of people, millions of people, are going to ultimately qualify for federal subsidies that will pay maybe even the entire monthly cost of some health plans offered on the exchanges. And other people are going to avoid the penalty because they meet one of the many exemptions. For instance, you're not required to buy insurance or pay a penalty if the cost of the insurance premiums would exceed 8% of your income. Another reason might be, you know, some sort of financial hardship that you could certify, such as, you know, facing foreclosure. Other religious groups will be exempt. And there's a long list of exceptions that you can find on the healthcare.gov website.
You know, thinking about someone who's going to try to judge this as a risk factor versus a cost factor, you know, it is, you mentioned the back issue, that there are odds as you get older. And a lot of this is you have to know yourself, your health, your family history.
Exactly. I mean, you can look at the odds, and the numbers are kind of interesting. Kaiser Family Foundation ran some numbers for me, and they found that there's a 5% chance of incurring at least $27,000 in medical bills in 2011 if you're somebody who's 25 to 34 years old. But, you know, as an individual, you're going to know your own odds better than looking at a statistic like that. It's really a personal decision, and we don't buy insurance because we expect to use it. We hope not to use it. It's really a matter of trying to minimize your financial risk. A lot of experts did point out that it is an issue of affordability. Of course it is. When the Affordable Care Act allowed young people to stay on their parents' policies up to their 26th birthday, 3 million more people under the age of 26 signed up for that. So clearly, you know, affordability is an issue.
Tara Siegel-Bernard is a reporter for The New York Times. Tara, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Carmen.
You can read more from our joint series at marketplacemoney.org or in the money section of the New York Times. This is Marketplace Money from APM.
So my question is, can I continue to do this?
I was wondering what your thoughts would be about
it. Would it be better to set it to...
I've been wondering whether it's really...
You know, that means it's time for your questions and our answers. Marinae joins us from Glendale, California, though I should call her Dr. Marinae, because she's a doctor and she has a question about her own health care. Hi, Marinae.
Hi, Carmen. Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be on the show, and it's been wonderful having you as a new hostess.
Oh, thank you so much. So let me ask you, Marinae, you have a question about your own healthcare savings. What is it?
I had a high deductible plan a few years ago when I was in private practice, and they had me start an HSA, which I thought was a wonderful idea. Now I'm with, through my husband, I have a Kaiser health plan, which is basically no copay, but I have the HSA still sitting there that I thought I could save for years to come and use it when I needed it.
Let's explain, you know, what it is. Basically, you can consider an HSA like a retirement account for your health care needs and expenses. And unlike a flexible spending account, which used to be a kind of use it or lose it, basically the HSA stays with you even if you change jobs.
I definitely was using it previously because I would go to the physicians and get a lab draw and that would cost me $1,000 or something like that. And so the HSA account was helping me at the time. But now that I have no copay, it's been sitting there and I thought it was going to grow like with interest. But all I see are monthly charges of $8.95 and a yearly growth of $7. Does it make sense to save it and just use it on really cool prescription glasses or...
Well, that may actually be a plan because the thing with the HSA is it does need to be used for qualified expenses. But there are implications when you take money out before retirement to not use for qualified expenses. You know, you may get hit with penalties and taxes. But to your point about, you know, that it's not growing, it's actually losing a little bit of money for you, you probably want to draw it down. The other thing, though, is thinking about if you can possibly either invest it or put it in such a way that you're not incurring these fees so that you're not losing money. Because the thing about an HSA is that even though your situation right now, you may not need it, you may down the road. So if you're not in dire straits, you may just consider having it on the side, just like someone who has an extra, you know, Roth IRA on the side.
Okay.
It's all a matter of how much you need access to that money.
So I have about 29, which is coming down to about 19 any day now, student debt. And so my husband's suggestion was, not realizing the penalties that we're going to incur if I took out that $3,000 or $4,000 from the HSA and paid towards the student loans.
Can I ask your interest rate?
It's 3.5, and I refinanced it about 10 years maybe ago. So my monthly is only about 480.
That's fantastic. No, but Marina, you got a great interest rate on that student loan. I wouldn't be in a big rush. 3% fixed, and the cost of cashing out that HSA.
Okay.
It's gonna cost you. So if you can calculate what are some of the medical expenses you have coming up, when I say medical, those fancy prescription glasses, that maybe you can use the HSA that way, and then the only thing you're going to be losing is that, you know, $7, that the maintenance fee.
Okay.
And Marina, can I ask you a question?
Of course.
We are talking so much about Obamacare and health care. Can I ask you, how does that affect you and what you do?
I work at the Veterans Administration Hospital currently, so it hasn't affected us just yet. We were told, or we were potentially warned, that we may lose some of the patients once these veterans realize they can join any other plan and go to any other hospital. But I don't quite see that happening, especially with a rough start of Obamacare sign-ups. So I think our veterans, I believe they will keep coming. And I believe if we maintain the quality of care, hopefully we'll maintain our patient load as well.
Marina, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. Thanks for the energy on the show, and I'll keep listening. Thank you.
Have a question for us? Go to marketplacemoney.org. Coming up, wallets beware.
The marketing is aggressive and arguably a little dishonest with respect to these cards because they're being positioned as a cheaper alternative to a checking account. And that's true if you write a bunch of bad checks every single month.
And having a baby. Is your money prepared? That's next on Marketplace Money from APM. To healthcare, there was some other major money news this week. News that matters to your wallet. Here to chat these financial headlines is our friend David Brancaccio. He's the host of the Marketplace Morning Report. David, thank you so much for joining us.
Of course. Good to see you.
Good to see you, my friend. So there's a couple news items, and I'm going to call you Macro Man here because you are macro.
It's the first time anyone's ever called me that.
Exactly.
But okay.
And I'm micro gal. So you look at these big news items, and you know they really do and can affect our wallet. One this week that was a big one was the Dow just touching 16,000, and it seemed like a very big deal. Was it?
There was a lot of hyperventilation about this. A lot of people are enjoying looking back 1 year and seeing the S&P 500 up about 30% in 1 year. Happy days are here again. But you called me macro man, so I want to look down at 30,000 feet for a second. If you look at where the Dow and the S&P were at the peak before the Great Recession, those indicators are up about 15 to 17% over 6 years. So that means we're not getting much out of the stock market if you were the longer-term investor. It's like 2.5%, 2.8%, or 2.9% on average through those years. There's still a lot more work to do.
So the Fed minutes from the last meeting this week said that the U.S. economy is improving steadily enough to warrant a reduction in its stimulus program in, quote, the coming months. So that means interest rates going up a bit. Now, I know that those cash savers out there, those money market folks, are like, yay, well, maybe I'll finally earn some money. But this really has some implications.
If there's one thing I can tell you about the future with great certainty, that the Fed's stimulus program, the extraordinary program of bond buying, will not continue forever. And people need to be prepared for this because a ton of money will suddenly begin to shift. Now, for people who depend on higher interest rates, the insurance industry, for instance, this is going to be pretty good news. For people who have been set up to profit from the old system where money is super cheap for corporations and interest rates are relatively low, they are going to have to adapt. One of my favorite stories of the past week was some of the smartest men and women in the room got this wrong. There was a moment when the Fed said they're not going to taper interest rates as expected. This happened earlier this fall. Goldman Sachs' currency people were not ready for this. Apparently, they lost about $1 billion overnight.
Gosh.
So these are the cleverest folks, supposedly.
What?
They got wrong-footed by this. You can't time this stuff. But I'll tell you one thing for sure. Interest rates are going to be trending upward in the foreseeable future.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're going to see mortgage rates go up. The rates are so low, there is no place else to go, pretty much. So we're going to see them go up. Our macro man here at Marketplace Money, David Brancaccio, is the host of the Marketplace Morning Report. David, thank you so much for joining us.
It is my pleasure.
And if you have questions about the headlines, head to marketplacemoney.org. Gearing up to swipe quite a lot of plastic this holiday season, though hopefully you're not carrying any balances. Don't carry a balance. Here to talk about the newest news and how we live plastic is credit expert John Altsheimer. Welcome, John.
Thanks for having me, Carmen.
So, John, here's a really big one. In terms of our revolving credit, the nationwide balance of how much we owe on non-asset-backed credit, like a mortgage, so credit cards and all that stuff, it's down again for the fourth consecutive month, down almost 3%. What's your take on that? Is this a consumer confidence issue? Are we going to all stop spending so much on cards?
You know, I think it's a combination of things, Carmen. I think to some extent, the past few years have served kind of as a frying pan upside the head and have taught us that, you know, carrying balances at 14 and 15% APR is not terribly smart. So many people have kind of seen the light and had the credit epiphany and have essentially moved away from revolving balances on their credit cards. There are still some consumers who are unable to get credit cards, and so they have been frozen out of the credit card market, but not by choice. They have essentially been forced out. And also, don't discount the possibility that the very, very aggressive marketing by the prepaid debit card issuers is working to some extent to convert some folks off of unsecured revolving onto those prepaid debit cards. So I think it's a combination of a variety of things.
Yeah, that part makes me sad, though, because that's, you know, the prepaid card, it doesn't build your credit. And they have a lot of fees, but they really have a tremendous amount of marketing and big companies like Walmart teaming up with Amex and all that. So do you see that that is going to take a bigger and bigger bite out of credit cards?
I do. And if you look at the speculative numbers over the next several years as far as the amount of money that's going to be loaded onto prepaid debit cards, the number is truly staggering, billions and billions of dollars. And you're right. I mean, look, there's a pro and there's a con to every financial services product. But the cons associated with the prepaid debit card seem to outweigh the pros. There is no credit building benefit. The marketing is aggressive and arguably a little dishonest with respect to these cards because they're being positioned as a cheaper alternative to a checking account. And that's true if you write a bunch of bad checks every single month. But for people who do manage their checking accounts properly and are willing to do a little bit of searching around for that free checking account, then a prepaid debit card is absolutely not cheaper in the long run.
And you know, John, one of the things that I feel like this is a reaction to, and let me know if you think the same, is the CARD Act. Because once the CARD Act came in and started putting limits on overdraft and credit cards and fees. You know, didn't the lenders have to find and banks had to find another way to make money? Is that what the prepaid card is?
That's actually very, very true. The Card Act did restrict the credit card issuer's ability to charge fees, punitive fees mostly. And credit card issuers are not dumb. They weren't going to just sit idly by and allow large chunks of their revenue to essentially be washed away by the act. And so they did have to react. And one of the reactions was to enter the prepaid debit card market. And every big bank that we know of is also now in the prepaid game. And that's partially why, is that they saw the momentum was truly building. And this was a good way for them to help to subsidize the cost of having to comply with the Card Act.
Talking more about the plastic in your wallet, I'm wondering how many people noticed that maybe they're using their debit card less, because Nielsen also reported this month that people are now using their credit cards again more. Now, the trend had been that folks were using debit more than credit, and that's been the trend in the past several years. And, you know, a lot of us in the business, of course, saying, yay, well, at least, you know, people aren't getting into credit card debt. But then, of course, debit cards became very expensive, and now folks have flipped, and now they're using credit cards. What do you think is behind that?
So a couple of things. Debit cards are the only financial services product that I've heard people use the word love when they're explaining. People love their debit cards, and rightfully so. There is no interest. There is no debt. There are no late payments. There are no due dates. Debit cards are a very, very effective tool to keeping you out of debt and keeping you under control, because you can only spend essentially what's in your checking account. And you'll notice that credit cards over the past couple of years have been very, very aggressive with their offers. The number of cards that are currently offering 0% balance transfer deals and 0% on new purchases and no balance transfer fees is staggering. And that's from 6 months to 18 months, which means that you can actually move a balance off of one card to another card and pay no interest for a year and a half. That's unheard of in the history of credit cards, and this is one of the reasons they're doing it, is they're trying really, really hard to get you back into the credit environment.
So, you know, that's how I got rid of my college debt, was flipping my balance when I graduated from card to card that had 0% for 18 months and then 0% to 18 months. So, you know, if that's coming back and we're seeing that so much more now, some folks can actually really use those, the savings of the interest there. They really would love to have that. And if they have great credit, they can save a lot of money. So where can you go if you're not getting those offers in your mailbox or via email? Where can you go to find those offers?
So there are a variety of websites that act as credit card strip malls, if you will, and you can shop for, or you can comparison shop a lot of those types of credit cards without actually going to the banks directly and doing your research at 15 or 16 different websites. I'll give you some examples. Mint.com is a good one. Bankrate.com is another good one. The company that I do work for, CreditSesame.com, is another good one. Credit.com is a good one. CardRatings.com is a good one. And essentially what they'll do is they'll allow you to compare different cards side by side based on things like terms, interest rates, credit limits, the amount of time you'll have a 0% introductory period. And you can just decide from that point which one you feel best fits your needs.
John Altsheimer is the credit expert at CreditSesame.com. Thank you, John, so much for joining us.
It was a pleasure. Thanks for having me, Carmen.
For those sites that John mentioned to comparison shop your plastic, head over to MarketplaceMoney.org and tell us, how's your credit looking? What's your plastic preference? Tweet at LiveMoney. Costs money, but sometimes it's hard to judge the price tag.
I have a question.
So my question is...
We're going back to the phones to talk to you about how you live money. And you know, this is about one of those amazing but pricey times in your life. Andrew and his wife are expecting their first baby, and he's got some big money questions about that. Welcome, Andrew.
Thank you, Carmen.
So, Andrew, talk to me. Your wife, congratulations, is expecting. Talk us through what your life is going to look like when the baby comes.
Well, what our life did look like is that we were double income, no kids, and our lifestyle came to a big halt. We like to dine out a lot, but that's been put on hold for the time being. We're mostly just curious of how it's going to affect our savings. Like, we maxed out our 401ks and put money into our IRAs, but we don't know if that's going to alter the percentages that go there or if we can keep living the lifestyle that we've lived, because obviously now we're going to have things like diapers and food and daycare.
Oh, that's just the tip of the iceberg, my friend. Actually, I'll throw some stats at you. The USDA's annual stat that was released over the summer says the cost for a middle-income couple to raise a child on average that was born last year till their 18th birthday is about $250,000.
Wow.
Now, that's very different in urban areas. So, for example, in the Northeast, that number is closer to almost $500,000. So here's the reality is that, of course, your finances are going to change drastically. But the reason why I asked you about what does your life going to look like is because I want to get an idea, besides cutting back on the restaurants, do you plan on staying put? Did you want to move? Did you want to buy or keep renting?
Well, I think we'll be renting for a while now. My wife's kind of looking for another position. So whether or not we stay in New York is up in the air right now.
Andrew, what about your living situation today? Do you find yourselves, you're saving well, but do you have cash savings on hand and wiggle room in your budget every month?
I think we do. We've got about $20,000 in savings. So, and of course, if we cut back on the dining out and other entertainment, then we can certainly save more.
You mentioned childcare. So the assumption is that you're both going to go back to work?
I believe so, yes.
That usually is the biggest expense. You know, nationwide, that can easily take up 10% of your budget. But I can tell you that actually, for most people, it tends to be a lot more than 10%. So you have to do some searching around as to what those costs may look like. And in general, for a lot of folks, we're talking, you know, could be a couple $1,000s a month. Or $1,000 a month. But the child's first year, there's many more expenses. What about medical and health care? How are you guys covered?
My wife has about 90% coverage, and my plan is 80%. So we're both separately, and we think about maybe there's a better family plan in the future. But yeah, the cost of that is a question mark too. Like, what does it actually cost to have the baby in the hospital? We have no idea.
A lot. Well, it costs a lot, but you guys do have some coverage, which is really important because, you know, childbirth can be medically a very expensive thing to happen and to do, and it all depends on the complications. Now, a lot of times you don't know how much it's going to cost until you actually go through it. Now, you can assume that if you're going to do this under your insurance, which covers 90%, that 10% could be pretty high depending on if there are any complications. So what you should be prepared for is you should be prepared to pay out of pocket anywhere from a couple of $100 to a couple $1,000s. Hopefully, the number will be on the low side because everyone will be healthy and everything will be fine. But it's always good, and I tell couples that are expecting or parents that are expecting, to look at their health care and look at be strategic as to what gets covered versus what is not, and estimate how much it may cost you, best case scenario and worst case scenario. So that could cost you some money just right up front, even before there's one diaper involved.
Okay, good to know.
So let's look at what those costs up front are going to be in that first year. Probably childcare if someone's going back to work. So you want to count on that and how much that's going to cost. The medical costs if you are not 100% covered as well. And don't forget that your monthly premiums will go up once your child is born. And then other things like clothes and, you know, strollers and car seats and all that other stuff as well add to that cost. And don't forget one thing, Andrew. Do you guys have life insurance?
Yes, we do.
You both do?
Correct.
Great, because you're going to need it. That's something that all parents should absolutely have. And a will and a trust.
That's something we haven't put together yet, but we definitely will very soon.
Great. That is so important for new parents. And so many parents don't do it. And I know you're going to get really busy. And once that baby comes, Andrew, there's going to be not that many brain cells left, awake brain cells left, to do stuff like that. So you take advantage of the time now to plan for something like that.
One other question is, now I guess we'll have a dependent deduction on taxes as well.
You will. You will have a dependent deduction. Another thing that you will probably be able to deduct, and this is depends on how you pay for childcare. If you pay for childcare through a licensed daycare provider and or you also pay benefits to a full-time babysitter or nanny or something like that situation where someone has a tax ID, those costs can also be deductible.
Oh, that's really good to know.
There are some savings in having a child. It definitely doesn't balance itself out, but at least you get a little bit of relief. And don't forget that if your adjusted gross income, your AGI, if your medical costs that are you incur with the birth of your child really exceed, I think the number is now 8.5%, you can also deduct that as well. So make sure you keep track of all of those co-pays and that additional 10% that you are having to pay due to your insurance coverage, or the 20%, whichever coverage you end up going with, add those all up and also apply those to your taxes if you can.
Okay, excellent.
So are you ready, Andrew?
Absolutely.
Andrew from New York, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Carmen.
And you can find the info I mentioned to Andrew at marketplacemoney.org. And while you're there, do me a favor, hit the record button under Ask Carmen to send in your question. More from our special collaboration with the New York Times, the new math of healthcare, and a question of long-term care.
Many people, to qualify and get a decent premium, need to apply in their 50s or 60s before they're ill. Once they need it, they no longer qualify for it.
Plus, working on Thanksgiving. Sometimes it's really all about the birds. That's next on Marketplace Money from APM. Continue with our special collaboration with the New York Times called The New Math of Healthcare. Now, I'm going to throw out a number to you. $1 million. That's a possible total of out-of-pocket expenses for a retired couple facing long-term care. It's a lot of dough. Ann Carnes joins me now. She's a reporter with the New York Times and wrote about this topic for our joint series. Welcome, Ann.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And, you know, $1 million, and we've heard some really giant numbers tied to out-of-pocket costs for retirees, even with all this new health care coverage. But how does that number get so big?
Well, it's important to remember that it is a large number and it can be scary, and it's not a number that would necessarily apply to most people or you individually. But it can get there under different scenarios depending on your particular situation. For example, each year Fidelity Investments does an estimate of retiree health costs for a couple. If a couple were to be 65 retiring this year, for example, they estimate that their out-of-pocket health spending throughout their retirement would be about $220,000. Depending on what assumptions you make, that number can get bigger or smaller. Some of the assumptions they make include that the couple lives to their early 80s, but many people now live into their 90s. And if you tweak the assumption to account for someone living into their early 90s or the couple living into their early 90s, the number gets much bigger, into $300,000+. And the estimate does not include any costs for long-term care, which can be quite expensive.
It's very expensive. And, you know, besides folks living longer, which, of course, the scariest thing is seeing the posters today that say that babies born today are most likely to live to 100. So this is the future. But, you know, also, too, you mentioned in your piece that nursing home costs, according to Genworth, are growing at more than 4% a year. And Is it true, though, that we are also in retirees are also taking on more costs? So it's not just the rising costs of the services, but it's also the fact that more of the cost is being put on the consumer. Is that the case?
Well, Genworth Financial estimates that the median cost for a nursing home now nationally is for a semi-private room is close to $80,000. It's in the upper 70,000s, and it's higher for a private room. If both members of a couple were to end up needing a nursing home, which is the most expensive form of long-term care, that would also increase their cost greatly. There are other types of long-term care that are not as expensive, such as assisted living or home care. The long-term care component can really be a big factor in health costs. And more than half, I believe roughly 65%, of people who reach 65 will end up needing some type of long-term care before they die.
Long-term care as we live older is becoming more and more of a concern for folks. But at the same time, a lot of big insurers are actually dropping long-term care insurance. What's going to work here in terms of long-term care? Does the insurance still help and can it?
The issue now is that there's been great sort of turmoil in the long-term care insurance market. It's become much more expensive and underwriting is much stricter. So some people can't qualify for long-term care insurance. But if they do qualify, it can provide help for people who do need long-term care as they age. It can cover at least part of the costs. The catch with long-term care insurance is that many people, to qualify and get a decent premium, need to apply in their 50s or 60s before they're ill. Once they need it, they're no longer qualified for it. So you could be faced with paying premiums for a good 15, 20 years or even more before you would file a claim. Some people look at the annual premium and think, well, I'll just take my chances.
So how are folks able to plan for this? I mean, is this about looking to pay for long-term care? Where's the planning part of this?
People do need to plan in some way for health costs when they retire. And that's sort of the message here, is that most people don't think of healthcare costs in the way that they need to. Healthcare costs can eat up a much larger proportion of people's retirement savings than they expect. So whether or not they're saving specifically for out-of-pocket costs or long-term care insurance, they should look into saving more to cover healthcare costs. And there are some mechanisms that can help people, such as health savings accounts, which are a tax-advantaged savings account that works sort of like an IRA for healthcare. You can put money into it pre-tax, and you can withdraw it tax-free as long as it's for healthcare purposes. But in order to qualify for these health savings accounts, you have to have a high-deductible health insurance plan. The IRS sets limits every year on what those deductibles are, and if you qualify, then you can have a health savings account. The accounts can be used in two different ways. It can be used in a short-term fashion to cover costs that your health insurance doesn't until you meet your deductible, for example. But many financial advisors urge people who can afford it to not touch the money, to essentially put money in it every year and let it grow to cover your costs in retirement.
Oh, Anne, so many hoops for us to go through. But it's really important to recognize that these costs are substantial in retirement and that we can do something about it. So thank you so much for joining us. Anne Carnes is a reporter with the New York Times. Anne, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You can read the entire series and see the math at marketplacemoney.org or at nytimes.com. So as Anne just pointed out, older Americans are facing more out-of-pocket costs as they retire. But really, regardless of your age or your income, all those premiums, those copays, prescription drugs, these costs matter, and they can be huge. Now we have a whole new set of options with Obamacare. So Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer joins us now to help sort this all out. Thank you for being here, Nancy.
Sure.
So, Nancy, there are so many options, actually, within the Affordable Care Act's new plan at healthcare.gov. Can you help us, give us a, navigate all these choices? What do we need to know?
Well, Carmen, if you are buying insurance on one of these healthcare exchanges, there are four main categories. There's bronze, silver, gold, and platinum. And the bronze plan is the cheapest, but it covers the least. It covers 60% of the cost of health services deemed essential under the healthcare law. The platinum plan, well, it would cover 90%. Well, if you're young, you're healthy, maybe you're young, invincible, you could go for a high deductible plan. You have a very low monthly premium, but if you do end up getting sick or going in the hospital, you're going to have to pay more. If you know you're going to be seeing the doctor a lot, if you have accident-prone kids like I do, you might want a little more certainty. So you want a plan that covers more but has a higher monthly premium. And that's what Suzanne Cleary decided to do. I talked to her recently. She's a paralegal in the Washington, D.C. area. Cleary and her husband, they have two kids. And she told me she just didn't want to deal with uncertainty.
For me, it's just about predictability of costs. I would just rather pay that premium every month, and then I don't have to worry that I'll be responsible for this deductible.
Well, that's the thing, is that you may pay a very low premium, but then your actual cost could end up so much higher. But are there different ways, Nancy, that we can save money that aren't particularly obvious in terms of choosing these plans?
Yeah, Carmen, I call it working the system, right? So a lot of employers offer discounts to employees who will do things like join an exercise program or a smoking cessation program to quit smoking. And the discounts that employers can offer for those kinds of programs are actually up under the Affordable Care Act. Now, that's Suzanne Cleary, who I just spoke with. She saves $144 a year filling out a health questionnaire for Kaiser. And there's another way that the Affordable Care Act can save you money. As I mentioned, it requires insurers to cover 10 essential health benefits. That includes stuff like preventive care, like flu shots or a physical. And if you're a family of four, that can really add up.
Oh, that absolutely adds up. Now, a lot of folks who are very money savvy talk and ask about and use health savings accounts and flexible spending arrangements. Now, some of this has changed, correct?
Yeah. Flexible spending arrangements have changed a little bit. Let me define what these things are first, right? There's a health savings account, and that's paired with that high deductible plan. So it helps you save up in case you do have to pay off that high deductible if you have an illness or an accident. And financial advisors generally say, look, have that money set aside in addition to, you know, at least 3 months' expenses. Have that money set aside so if you do have to pay that deductible, you actually have it on hand. Now, a flexible spending arrangement is something that you get through work. And it is a lump sum of money that you set aside before taxes and you use it for healthcare expenses. Now, I talked with Matt Isles about this, and he's with Avalere Health, which is a healthcare consulting company here in Washington. He says you have to plan really carefully when you're deciding how much to set aside in your FSA.
So it is important to look exactly at, you know, what drugs am I taking? What type of care do I expect to use on a routine basis? And then whether you want to set aside any for an emergency or unexpected medical events.
And Carmen, President Obama's health care law did change FSA contribution limits. They're lower than they were. But starting in 2014, the IRS will allow employees to carry over up to $500 of unused FSA money to the next year. So it's not a complete use it or lose it situation.
Oh, that's good news, because the use it or lose it was always a barrier for me. So that's really
Absolutely.
Good news. Now, you said we got to do our homework. I get it. We got to take a lot of responsibility for this. But what about some folks who just need an extra helping hand? They need someone to guide them through the system. Is there anybody out there to help?
Carmen, if you want to, you can go to an insurance broker, and that is somebody who you don't pay directly. The insurance plan will pay the broker, but the broker can point you to certain plans and say, look, this might be a good value for you. Keep in mind, the broker is going to point you to certain plans, so you might want to get an estimate from a broker and then go back to the healthcare exchanges and say, is that a good deal? Could I get a better deal on the exchanges? But if the broker's offering you a good deal, he or she can actually do all the paperwork and sign you up, and you don't even have to deal with the exchanges and you get insurance.
Oh, it's good to know that there's a little bit of hand-holding out there. Thank you so much, Nancy, for joining us.
You're welcome.
You've had a lot of help with that and a lot of great information. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer, thank you.
You're welcome.
Have a money question? Shoot us an email, post on Facebook, or head to Twitter at LiveMoney. Or you can record your question at MarketplaceMoney.org, right under that Ask Carmen button. It's your money. It's your voice. Here's our voicemail of the week.
Hi, my name is Nick, and I'm an educator in the Chicagoland area. I'm 29 years old and single. I actually have two master's degrees worth of debt, totaling around $60,000, but I've managed to pay off around $30,000 of that. I've never used credit cards really before, except for running them up over the course of a week and then paying them off every week so I don't accrue interest. My credit limit on the one credit card I do have is very low, like $2,200. My concern is that after my student loans are paid off, the next thing to look at is buying a home. And with no loans on my record, I'm going to have very little evidence of managing credit. Should I open up a new credit card just to get a higher credit limit and continue my same spending habits?
Well, Nick, you are credit phobic, and that's okay, because I have a cure. Here's what you got to do. Understand that what you were doing by taking your cards and paying them off every week was pretty savvy. What you got to do, though, is have more cards. So what I recommend you to do, because you are concerned about carrying a balance, is find a card and use it just for one thing on your budget, or two. I call it your GG card, your gas and groceries. So you rotate a couple of cards through your wallet that you just use for certain particular expenses so you don't go crazy. Shop around for cards that give you some rewards, like points or reward points. You don't have to be credit phobic. You just got to know how to use credit right. Give yourself a little time when you get into this business, and you will be just fine for getting that home.
Please leave a message after the tone.
If you want to leave us a voicemail like Nick, it's easy. Visit MarketplaceMoney.org and select the record audio button. So now I have a question for you. How are you planning to spend Thanksgiving Day? Maybe you're going to be in the kitchen. Maybe you're going to be on the couch. Or, like my beloved sister-in-law, are you going to be hitting the stores? A lot of retailers who employ a lot of people are now making it possible for you to get your shopping fix on Thanksgiving Day. Now, I've worked many Thanksgiving days in my life and knew it wasn't always fun. Terry in Rochester, Minnesota wrote in. She shares that sentiment. She's working retail on the holiday, and she says it's at no extra pay. Brian in Stevens City, Virginia, he says it's sad to miss time with his son because, quote, commercials tell people that they need to shop. But not everyone who has to work on Thanksgiving is complaining.
Hi, I'm Ruth Anessian. I have been running the Animal Exchange, a retail pet store in Rockville, Maryland, since 1979. Going in on Thanksgiving Day is actually very lovely because I get to talk to all the visitors that are not two-legged. Well, some of them actually are, but they also have wings. The most important thing when I go into work is to turn the lights on, because birds don't eat in the dark. When the lights are on, everything comes to life. It's really quite amazing. And they're so pleased when you go in and greet them. We have some baby cockatiels we're hand-feeding. The good news is they're down to twice a day, so I will only have to go in twice to feed them on Thanksgiving. My family is perfectly happy for me to go into work because I generally stuff the turkey before I leave in the morning, and it's cooking while I'm gone. I get a lot of people who assume I'm a vegetarian, which I'm not. Turkeys are raised for food. They are raised appropriately and well for food, and I am happy to indulge in them. Growing up in New York City in a not very wealthy environment, I had a pair of binoculars. So I started bird watching. Girl Scouts got me even more into it, and I decided I would go to Cornell University, where they had a major in birds. I remember in my high school yearbook, mine said, I was always a lover of soft-winged things. I am so thankful for all the people that care for their pets as well as our customers do. And that makes my business one that I will always enjoy. I know I'm way beyond retirement age for many of my classmates from school, but I can't think of any place that I'd rather be than at Animal Exchange for any holiday or any day of the year.
Ruth Hanessian is a bird expert, turkey and otherwise, and the owner of the Animal Exchange in Rockville, Maryland. That's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, money, family, and the holidays. Marketplace Money is produced by Dan Gretsch, Nancy Fargali, Raghu Manavalan, Mary Dew, Candice Manriquez, and Lindsay Foster Thomas. Charlton Thorpe is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Carmen Wong Ulrich. Remember, always check with your financial pro before making any big money moves. Thanks for listening, and let's talk soon. This is APM.